Welcome to Let's Talk Legal, part of Coastal Daybreak every Tuesday morning and brought to you by Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. You can call in now to have your legal questions answered by attorneys Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. Call in now with your questions at 252-247-7282.
And Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins are with us this morning. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Hey, Ben.
All right, what are we talking about today?
Well, we're good, Ben. It's nice to have Wes here. Wes, we're going to talk about a jury trial because Wes is here to talk about it.
Okay. All right. Good.
Last week, as we know, Wes was busy in probably a deposition or hearing or trial. He usually is. But Ben, the last few weeks when Wes has been here, we have been talking about the stages of litigation in terms of, well, really the stages of a jury trial, to be more specifically.
Right.
And just to review a little bit, you know, it starts with the introduction of the case with regard to the jury, with picking a jury, the voir dire, that's called, that's the technical name for that, impaneling a jury. And then, of course, there are the opening statements, which are not evidence, but which is a preview, if you will, a snapshot given by each of the lawyers as to what they anticipate their particular aspect of the file is going to show, their aspect of the case, kind of an outline, if you will, of the factual evidence. Of course, all along the way, there are motions with regard to evidence, with regard to things that can be admissible, not admissible. Some of that is handled pre-trial, before the trial, by motions. We've talked about this on the program, where there are motions that will limit the evidence or even limit who maybe a witness might be or what they might say. That is known in the law as a motion in limine. But anyway, the case proceeds on with the jury and with the judge, and the evidence is presented by testimony.
Right.
Okay, by the admission, as Wes mentioned last time, of evidence, admitting documents, if you will, into evidence. They have to be formally introduced into evidence by motion by the lawyers. And then, of course, Wes, you're at the point of what, about midway now? And there would be motions, of course.
Yeah, I think we're up to closing arguments.
Okay. I think that we had gone through, you know, the plaintiff side putting on evidence, defense side, you know, going through evidence. We talked about the directed verdict motions. We talked about the fact that when you make a directed verdict motion, that's basically a motion to dismiss the other side's case. Defense is going to do that at the close of plaintiff's evidence and all evidence, and then that preserves your right for some post-verdict relief, post-judgment relief is what it's called, and it's kind of a no-no not to do that. You just always do that even if you know you're going to lose. You know, always let my client know that, you know, don't worry when we lose this motion.
Right.
I just got to do it, you know, and it's just kind of the process that you go through.
Sort of pro forma.
And sometimes you feel like you are going to win the motion, just depending on what the evidence, you know, was in the particular case. So once all the evidence in and both sides have rested and, you know, you're at a point where you're ready to wrap this case up, then finally the attorneys get to argue. You don't really get to argue until that point because, like we talked about, the opening statement is really just an opening statement. It's just a statement with regard to what we think the evidence is going to show in the case. It's not an argument where we're characterizing evidence and, you know, making actual legal argument about things in the case. So, but before you get to that point, as I think we mentioned a couple weeks ago, or I mentioned a couple weeks ago when I was here, we do have a charge conference. We talk about what the instructions are going to be to the jury, which are vitally important.
Seems like when we hear appeals, it's often about the jury instruction.
Yeah, a lot of times you have instructions to the jury where they're inappropriate instructions given or not consistent with the law or some of those kind of things. So, yeah, you do read generally in the public articles, you know, about that, hear about that on TV, so on and so forth, news outlets. So the jury instructions are very important. And, you know, a good Superior Court judge is going to know basically the canned instructions. You have some general canned instructions, basic instructions, cookie cutter instructions that you give with regard to, you know, every, and I'm talking about civil cases here, with regard to every civil case, such as, you know, the burden of proof, such as things like, you know, what is greater weight of the evidence? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there's a difference here between reasonable doubt, obviously, in the criminal,
right,
and then greater weight of the evidence.
Right.
And, you know, I describe that as greater weight of the evidence is kind of like 51%.
Mm-hmm.
Which way do the scales of justice tilt? So there's those standard instructions. And then in a lot of different types of cases, like your standard contract case, negligence cases, you know, really a broad scope of different types of cases that are pretty well settled, you have pattern jury instructions. You know, what that is basically there's a committee that operates to update those so that the instructions that are given to the jury come from a pattern instruction that's available to judges and available to the lawyers.
Okay.
So that really to hopefully minimize the possibility of some mistake being made by giving incorrect instructions.
Now, in North Carolina, I don't mean to jump ahead, but I want to come back to it. But in North Carolina, do the juries actually then not only decide fault, but also awards?
Oh, yeah.
So so are there instructions about limits on that? Or
There are instructions regarding damages, different types of damages, consequential damages, direct damages, you know, those type things, punitive damages. There are certain particular areas where the judge would have the authority with regard to the damage because it's a set amount of damage set forth in a statute. I don't want to jump around too much, but since we're on this, I'll mention it. One example with regard to that would be your unfair and deceptive trade practices. And if you have an unfair and deceptive trade practices claim, that's normally a bifurcated situation. First of all, you try your underlying case. And then in the event the unfair and deceptive trade practices claim is a secondary, tertiary claim in addition to the other claims, then that issue is tried next.
Right.
So then the jury would make a determination on unfair and deceptive trade practice, such as, you know, number one, was this of and affecting commerce? Number two, you know, was it an unfair and deceptive trade practice? And then obviously the judge has already given them instruction about what an unfair and deceptive trade practice is. So then what do we have? We have a damages award, okay, let's say of $100,000, just round number. And then we have a jury, if they come back and say, yes, this was unfair and deceptive trade practices, they don't have the right at that point in time to decide what the additional damages are going to be because the statute already says treble.
Okay.
Right, so. It says treble. So then it kicks it to the judge, and the judge is going to enter the final judgment on that or order, trebling those damages from 100 to 300. And also the statute allows for the recovery of reasonable attorney's fees as well. And that would be something that in most cases would be submitted to the judge for determination.
The judge will determine that.
Yep, as to whether the attorney's fees are reasonable, and those will be affixed, you know, on the judgment or final order. So, you know, basically the jury does have a right to, you know, write in the actual amount of the damages. I mean, they have to do that in most cases, but if you have a statutory amount such as treble, then boom, that's they make a determination as to whether it was an unfair deceptive act. And then the judge is going to do the times three and enter that.
Seems like juries have a pretty complicated job, actually, in a civil case.
They do, but the instructions are fairly straightforward. They're a whole lot simpler for me than I'm sure they are for them,
right?
You know, because I'm used to hearing all this stuff. But you know, when those instructions are given, I really. It's pretty obvious to me that most juries, when they have sat through an entire trial and they've listened to both lawyers, they've listened to this evidence, they're listed closing argument, and
they're ready.
They're at a point where now the judge is reading off all this complicated stuff to them. I think they glaze over a little bit. One of the things that I do, though, is I ask them to focus on the areas that I think are important in the jury instructions. I ask them to listen to Judge Jones or Judge Henry.
Is that in your closing you would do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Listen to Judge Jones or Judge Henry or Judge Alford or whoever it may be when he or she, Judge Gorham, reads off the jury instructions here, and I want you to pay attention to the requirements for this, mm-hmm. because this is what the requirements are going to say. Because right. you know, I almost always make it a point in a jury trial to focus in specifically right from the beginning as to what the jury is going to consider. And what mm-hmm. you're going to consider, the judge is going to tell you at the end of the day. And all I'm really going to ask you to do is consider the evidence and take into consideration what the jury instructions say. They're not going to come from my mouth.
Right.
The instructions, they're going to come from the judge's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if we can kind of focus mm-hmm. on the elements that I think are important that the jury needs to really focus on, then a lot of the noise of the jury instructions, mm-hmm. I think in many cases it helps them to try to listen for what I tell them is coming right. with regard to that.
Right.
So they can focus a little bit on that.
Ben, we need to recall that the jury is the determining facts, okay,
mm-hmm.
Is the determiner of the facts of the case. And what do we kind of mean by that is that, was there undue influence?
Mm-hmm.
Was there competency? Did he slow down at the right time? Was he supposed to see this pedestrian on the sidewalk?
Mm-hmm.
The determiner of the facts. We need to keep in mind, as we've reviewed so many times here, that, the judge is the ruler of the law. And the jury, many times doesn't realize
mm-hmm.
that certain issues have been ruled upon by the judge long before the jury is impaneled, that those issues are not going to be determined by the jury.
Right.
There's
right.
been a motion for summary judgment on that issue. Or maybe there was some other, there was certain evidence that was excluded
mm-hmm.
that the jurors do not know about. So the jurors are in a, you were talking about, how they perceive things. They are limited in they do not know the whole story necessarily.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this is good because it keeps them focused on the particular fact that the judge and the juror, that the judge and the lawyers are needing to be determined by clear and convincing evidence in a civil case.
We'll have more to come in a moment here on a Coastal Daybreak and Let's Talk Legal. If you would like to ask your questions, you can give us a call at 247-7282. That's 252-247-7282. And welcome back here on Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240. Every Tuesday morning, Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. You can follow along at harvellandcollins.com. You can also actually follow along on Facebook Live, too, on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station. And we also have a chance for you on their website at harvellandcollins.com to look up past programs by their subject matter. We're talking about juries, and you're almost to the jury box now, or almost to the jury room now, right?
Right, so we've had the charge conference. Briefly, I did talk about the pattern jury instructions, but you also have the right to ask the judge for special jury instructions, like if there's a particular special issue and there's mm-hmm. a case on point. A lot of judges will agree to do that if it applies, but they're going to only use particular quotes from the case you're referring to.
Okay.
They're not going to try to interpret it so much. They're going to want to just read whatever,
mm-hmm.
precedent there may be that we don't have a pattern in jury instruction on relative to that. So that's something you take into consideration if there's a particular special issue that hasn't been dealt with in a pattern instruction. And frankly, in a lot of the fiduciary litigation that I deal with, that's kind of an area where the pattern jury instructions, it's not as complete as, say, like your negligence case, car accident,
right,
personal injury type situation. So sometimes you have those type situations, that come up. So we're at a point where the closing argument is done. Both sides have argued. The jury has given the instructions, and then sent back into deliberations, into their private room where mm-hmm. they can finally discuss it. Because they've been told at this point in time, don't talk about the case.
Right.
You know, don't talk amongst yourself. So my understanding is that they're, you know, if it's a significant trial that's gone a week or so, then they're dying to finally talk about the thing, mm-hmm. you know, because they're probably interested in what the person sitting next to them thinks about it, so on and so forth. In my first 2 or 3 years of practice, I actually sat on a jury. Mm-hmm. I was summoned to jury duty, and I knew the lawyers. It was a criminal case, and I couldn't believe that they wanted a lawyer.
They kept you.
Yeah, they kept me. But I learned a lot from that because, you know, sitting there in the actual trial itself, obviously, you're just sitting there listening, paying attention, being attentive. But then when we go into deliberations, the immediate thing that the other jurors start talking about is, you know, I don't like her, and I don't
right.
I don't think, you know,
the impressions.
Yeah, impressions. So I made the point, there were two charges. I made the point to request from the court the jury instructions, mm-hmm. and they sent the jury instructions back, and that to the other jurors was like a novel idea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is that? What are we doing? Well, and I explained there are elements to this crime and elements to that crime. So let's just go through each element and see if the burden was met as to each element. And so that helped me a lot, kind of have more insight mm-hmm. as it relates to, you know, how this process works. And in many cases, depending on the circumstances, but in many cases in my closing, I will suggest to the jury that if they want to request the jury instructions print it out to consider and to look at the elements, then all they have to do is ask for it, and I would.
Oh, that's not automatically provided.
I would suspect that the court will send it back. If they want to see any piece of evidence, mm-hmm. if they want to see a document or whatever, they may ask for those things.
Mm-hmm.
So there they are. The first thing that they do, obviously, is they appoint a foreperson,
mm-hmm.
and then once they've done that, then they go into their deliberations. And on a civil case here, we're talking about North Carolina State Court. It's unanimous. Mm-hmm. So, you know, either you carry the burden of proof or you don't. You know, if you're the plaintiff, it's your burden of proof.
Right.
Then you have to convince. So that would be your burden. You know, normally it's 12. Some in some type of situation, statutorily it's less.
Mm-hmm. Do they generally take a vote right away?
I mean, I really can't say. I've mm-hmm. only been in one.
You've been
deliberation.
In one. Yeah, right.
And I don't think that's what we did right away.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really remember. It's been so long ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that they just, you know, generally get themselves organized in whatever way they deem appropriate and start talking about it.
I would think at a civil trial, you'd also have people, something is involving money, that people would relate their own experiences. They would probably start falling back on some of that.
Another very important issue with regard to this is that they're given what's called a verdict sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the verdict sheet really asks them to answer issues.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've talked about over the years on this program that really when you start in a litigation process, a lawsuit process, the funnel is pretty broad.
Mm-hmm.
And then the funnel gets a little narrower through like motions for summary judgment, motions to dismiss. Narrows down a little further discovery. You get to trial, pretrial order gets mm-hmm. a little bit narrower. Directed verdict gets a little bit narrower. Well, now we're at the very end of the funnel
mm-hmm.
because the issues are then brought before the jury. And so all this time and effort moving and money moving toward this resolution, and really it comes down to normally just a couple questions that the jury answers yes or no on the verdict sheet.
Ah,
and the verdict sheet basically is, you know, we look at what the claims that are remaining. We mm-hmm. look at what the issues are before the jury. Normally the attorneys are going to agree. If they don't, the judge is going to establish what the verdict sheet's going to state. And they just have a little line where they put yes or no.
Right.
And then there will be, you know, line, if you answer yes on this and yes on that, then what's the amount of damages? And then they write in the damages.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's the very end of the funnel where we've really gotten to these issues.
Okay. We'll have more coming in just a moment here. If you'd like to still call in and ask a question, 247-7282. As we continue with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, you can find them online at harvellandcollins.com. Hey, welcome back here on Coastal Daybreak, and let's talk legal with Harvell and Collins, and we're in the jury room.
Right. So what does the lawyer do during this period of time? Well, normally you're packing up your stuff, you know, getting your Elmo, you know, if you use the overhead projector thing, back in the car, and you're getting organized and kind of cleaning up. And you know, it's kind of a nervous time. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes when you're in your closing, you get the head nods. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you don't.
Sense.
Sometimes the other side's maybe getting some positive affirmation. You just really don't know. I mean, even when I've had like probably the best case I could ever think of, and I just know I'm going to win this trial, in many cases you just have stone-faced jurors, and you don't know exactly which way is going to go. You don't know which jurors are going to be the leaders and which ones are going to be the followers. You don't you don't know what they're going to say. So it is a kind of a nerve-wracking, you know, situation. So they come out, obviously, and we've seen it on TV. You know, the verdict is then right. announced, and that's about the only part of the TV drama law stuff that's relatively accurate. Mm-hmm. You know, it's read either by the clerk or read by the judge. I mean, normally it's read by the judge, handed to the clerk, and then it's read, and then it's affirmed, you know, by the members of the jury.
And in that case, and they're reading out what they find for either the plaintiff or the defendant there, and then they also read the damages?
Yeah, the whole thing. Okay. Yep. Unless you get to a point where, let's say there's a liability issue and then a damages issue, but they answer no on liability, so you never get to damages. Because if you answer no on liability, there's not any damages.
Yeah, right.
So that could be, you know, that situation. So I do want to wrap this up this week. I know we just have a couple minutes left. So you do have the right for post-judgment relief if you move for directed verdict and renewed that motion. So even if the jury comes back in your favor, in the event that the judge thinks that you didn't put on the evidence to support the verdict, they can grant what's called a judgment notwithstanding the verdict. So even the judge has some control at that point in time. And you would think, well, why would the judge want it to go to a jury? Sometimes the judges will just, they think that there's not enough there, or they think that, you know, there wasn't an element that was met of the particular claim, but they're still interested in what the jury will do. But then when it comes back, they think the law, you know, doesn't support what happened, so they'll grant that JNOV. Then have appeal rights after that, so it kind of can go on.
Find out more by calling on the folks at Harbell and Collins, attorneys at law. You can call for that appointment at 726-9050.